folks, this is Pastor Mike Hoggard coming to you from Studio 2014 with another Watchman video broadcast. We're dealing with the secret of the seal. And anybody who's ever looked at the back of the $1 bill, of course, we look at the front and there's old George Washington, first president of the United States and a Freemason. I don't know that he had any input on the design of the seal of the United States of America, although he did have a lot of input into the sacred geometry of planning the federal city, Washington, D.C. But there were other hands involved in designing this, and we've already covered many of the ideas that we've looked at, especially from the scriptures, that there was a spirit that was guiding these people, or this person, in putting all of these things in here. We're going to be looking at a particular number that keeps showing up on the design of the great seal that's on the back of the $1 bill. I want you to take a look at this, and you'll see what I'm getting at here. I want you to notice that in the field of clouds, there are 13 stars. E pluribus unum, there are 13 letters, although there should be 14, and I'll explain why in a little bit. 13 stripes on the shield, 13 leaves and olives on the branch, 13 arrows, and it all wasn't always like that. At one time, the olive branch that the eagle held in its claw didn't have 13 leaves and 13 olives. That came about over time. Someone made it to be exactly the number 13. When we look at the obverse of the Great Seal, you have Anno et Coeptus, 13 letters. There are 13 rows of bricks or stones in the unfinished pyramid, with the 14th part of it being the missing part of it. We'll explain what that means in just a little bit. And then look back here. You have 1776, the Roman numerals. Well, those aren't 13. But Novus Ordo Seclorum, the number of letters added to MDCCLXXVI, if you know your Roman numerology, that's 1776. When you add Novus Ordo Seclorum and the Roman letters here, you have exactly 26, which is 13 times 2. So, we have all of these number 13s on the back of the $1 bill. Now, some would say, okay, you idiot Hoggard, it's because we had 13 original colonies that formed this nation. It was the beginnings of the United States of America. Yes, I absolutely agree with that, and I think there is a reason why we had exactly that many number of colonies who wanted to become states, who wanted to become independent nations, and then grouped together into, we use this term all the time, we don't really think of it, the United States. Do you know what that means? It means that Colorado. It means that Delaware, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Virginia, and these other colonies were individual states. They had their own form of government, their own rule. They had their own rulers over them. They agreed to take their 13 and join them all together to form one country called the United States. And I'm going to show you what is the symbolism behind. What was this, just a random act of, well, we just happen to have this number of colonies that joined together? Was that just a random number, or was there a secret design? Now, the rule to any good conspiracy theory is that you have to have someone in charge of the conspiracy. In other words, if we were to say that everybody who was ruling over the colonies back around the time of 1776, everybody that was ruling over them was in a secret organization called the Illuminati, and they were traveling to France all the time for meetings and so on and so on, that doesn't work. It just doesn't work. If we believe, however, what is in the word conspiracy is the letters S-P-I-R-A, spira, which is where we get the word spirit from. If we believe, as the Bible says in Ephesians chapter 2, that there is a prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience. If we believe that the devil has an agenda. He always has had an agenda. And that agenda is to rule the world, to sit on God's throne, like we see in Exodus 28, like we see in 2 Thessalonians 2, and other places. Revelation chapter 12 comes to mind. If we believe that the devil has a conspiracy and he wants to bring that about, then it's not hard for us to understand how the spirit of Lucifer and the spirit of, and all these spirits that work with him, brought together the formation of this nation, the design of the elements that are on the Great Seal, the layout of Washington, D.C., and everything that we know to be of occult origin or occultly related in the formation of our country. It doesn't take a genius to figure out there was a hidden hand involved in all of these things. We're going to look at the number 13. We're going to find out what it means from the scriptures. We're going to see how it is used in the Illuminati, in Freemasonry, in the New Age, in the occult. We're going to bring Joseph Smith in on this. We're going to bring some New Age concepts, and we're going to teach you some things that these guys have said, this is what our agenda is, this is what our goal is, and we're going to find out that God saw it and said, oh, I already know that one. I already know it. I already wrote about it in the scriptures. We're going to let the scriptures teach us about what's going on and about the symbolism of this particular number. Now, the number 13 immediately jumps out in my mind when I started doing this research. Immediately jumps out in my mind. There is a there are two branches of Freemasonry operating in the United States. Both of them came over from Europe, specifically from England. You have the Scottish Rite, which came from Scotland, which has exactly 33 levels in it. You also have the York Rite of Freemasonry, which came from York, England. And incidentally, but not accidentally, it has 13 rituals or 13 rites or 13 levels. Is there a connection between Freemasonry or, let's say, York Rite Freemasonry, the fact that it has 13 levels, and all of the number 13s that we see on the back of the $1 bill? There is, along with the York Rite of Freemasonry, there is a secondary branch under the York Rite, which is called Royal Arch Masonry. The symbol of the York Rite of Freemasonry is a ladder, and this particular ladder has exactly 13 steps, and it goes from the bottom up to the top. There at the top, you see the phrase, "There shall ye find light." Now, I want you to understand something a little bit about Freemasonry that makes it different. Freemasonry and lots of other pagan religions, witchcraft, Satanism, and so on, they all believe in rituals, that you must perform rituals. They also all believe that you ascend gradually from a low state to a higher state by taking steps. It's sort of like evolution. And I want you to think about that, because that plays very importantly into this understanding of the number 13. Because if we look back here, let's go back to the graphic of the unfinished pyramid. You note that the pyramid has 13 rows of stones or 13 rows of bricks. And then it stops. And then hovering above that is the all-seeing eye. It's the eye of Horus. It's the supposedly the all-seeing eye of God. I don't think so. God has two eyes. The God of the Bible has two eyes. There is another shepherd that has had one eye put out. He is referred to in Zechariah as the idol shepherd, I-D-O-L, shepherd. And he has had his right eye put out. This eye here is not the eye of the God that you and I believe in from the scriptures. This is the Antichrist is what it is. But here's this number 13. And if we go back to this graphic of the York Rite, you see evolution taking place. You see, here is man. Let's say he's a Neanderthal man. And he's going to evolve into a higher form. His brain's going to get bigger. His speech is going to develop more. He's going to have more skills to do with his hands and so on. So now we get to the point where we are now. We are at the verge in human history. We are on the verge of taking a giant leap in evolution, because now the scientists who are working all over the world, being led by spirits, no doubt in my mind about it. Scientists working all over the world are working feverishly, day and night, looking at biology, looking at nanotechnology, looking at robotics, looking at supercomputers who can crunch billions and trillions of calculations all in a matter of a few seconds, working on genetics, trying to get man over the hump up to that next level. Go back and look at this ladder again. 13 rungs on this ladder that man ascends and climbs up to be a higher level, a higher form of being. But we're sort of at a stopping point here, and we need something. We need a boost to get us up to that 14th rung. And that's really what this number has everything to do with. It represents something that's not quite finished yet, but it's going to be. So the York Rite of Freemasonry, this ladder of evolution, and I started out saying this a while ago, this is what separates Masonry from Bible Christianity. Masonry says, you want to see the light? Yes, I want to see the light. You've got to go through the rituals, one step at a time. While you're down here, we can't tell you the light. You're too low. You can't handle it. We've got to bring you up step by step. And isn't that exactly how the devil works? Remember, he's a serpent and he's more subtle than any beast of the field. And he always brings in his doctrine and his ideas by levels or grades or graduation. Whereas the Bible teaches us when we want the light of the scriptures, when we want the light of the Holy Ghost in us, the Bible says, whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved. And that's it. We go from death to life. We go from darkness to light, just like that. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye. That's how it happens with God's people and in God's way. But the devil says, oh no, you've got to work your way up here and you've got to do all these levels and you've got to do all this stuff. And that's what Freemasonry is all about. So the York Rite of Freemasonry has as its goal the ascension of man and turning men into something that is above men. What is that? Gods. It's exactly what the devil promised Eve in the Garden of Eden. Ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. So take a look at this ladder again. Can you think of something we've already seen in the Bible, Jacob's ladder? Can you think of something in humans that looks like a ladder? You just hang on to that one, all right? Right now it's kind of a twisted ladder, but we'll get there. But this ladder goes from earth to heaven. It is the connection. I want you to remember that. The ladder is the connection between earth and heaven. It's what bridges the gap between them. Now, in the York Rite of Freemasonry, you have a secondary branch of the York Rite called the Royal Arch Masonry. Here is the Masonic apron that Royal Arch York Rite Masons wear. Have you seen that symbol before? I have, and I'm sure that you have. It's the Gmail symbol. Now, take back a look at this, okay? I want you to notice that on the York Rite apron and the Gmail logo, they both have a letter in there. It's the letter M. So what big gigantic secret does the letter M have? Well, let's think about this. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M. The letter M is the number 13. Okay. You do the math. You sing the song in your head, A, B, C, D. You'll come to the same conclusion, I promise you. All right, now, in Scottish Rite Masonry, we're going to switch over here. Here's York Rite Masonry. It has 13 degrees, and it has this little sub-branch of Masonry called the Royal Arch degree. In Scottish Rite Masonry, you have a degree called the Royal Arch of Solomon. And here is a graphic. I'm going to open up the book here. I don't know if I can find it very quickly in here. It's from chapter XIII. You know what that is? That's a 13. I remember that from public school. Chapter 13, the 13th degree of the Scottish Rite of Freemasonry is called the Royal Arch of Solomon. Now, anytime in Masonry, they mention guys like Solomon or Hiram Abiff, you're dealing with the biblical account, although they take it way beyond the biblical account. You're dealing with the story of Solomon. And what did Solomon do? He had Hiram Abiff, a widow's son, come in and build the temple for him. So the idea is that Hiram Abiff had the secret knowledge. He had the secret on how to build temples. And Hiram Abiff was a stonemason, and he had the secret of being able, and I want you to think about where masonry gets its ideas from. It goes back to the old stonecutters and the old stonemasons who worked in guilds, and they had little secret signs between them, and they used to notch their stones with these little marks on them. I'm not making that up. That's what they used to do. Every stonecutter had his particular mark, and when he was building something, he would put his mark on a particular stone. That would tell all the other stonemasons, I was here. Okay, like Kilroy was here or something like that. But anyway, these masons, they had tricks. My father-in-law taught me, he said, Mike, there's a trick to every trade. And these stonemasons had their tricks. They had ways of doing things that when you saw the finished product, you would go, how in the world did they do that? How did they get that up there? And these trade secrets were just that. They were closely guarded secrets by these particular stonemasons. One of those secrets was how to get these stones and make a doorway out of them. How to do that? Well, somebody probably a long time ago, I don't know who did it, conceived of what was called the arch. And that is, yes, I live in St. Louis, I know what it is. The arch, and that is building these stones up and making them come around so that they touch at the top. And the strength of that arch is absolutely incredible because the design of it, engineers and people like that look at these arches and they can dissect it all out for you and show you how this much weight is on this piece here and how much whatever. I don't understand all that, but they do. But these stonemasons knew these secrets. So you transfer that into a society with a secret, and they take the ideas from the stonemasons and they mix them in with a secret occult knowledge that has been around since before the flood, after the flood. Nimrod, I think, knew it. We're going to bring him up here in just a little bit. But that was their idea. They bring these stonemason ideas and they teach these concepts of a mystery religion. I want you to look at this particular arch. There's several arch symbols. I want you to notice there on the left, you have two columns, two pillars. We know those to be Jachin and Boaz. We know from the scriptures that Jachin was 23 cubits tall, that Boaz, not just the pillars, but the chapiters that were on the top, the capitals, that Jachin and Boaz were both 23 cubits tall. 46, number of chromosomes, DNA, the ladder. Starting to see where we're going with this. Take a look at it again. You have Jachin and Boaz, and then you have these stones coming up out of the top of it, arching over to reach one another, but they can't quite do it. They need something that will be the connection between one column and the other column. I'm explaining this to you how Pike does it, Manly Hall does it, some of these other Masonic authors and Masonic teachers. This is how they teach it. You have this column and this column. This column represents the earth and earthly things. This column represents heavenly things or celestial things. Think of the ladder. It goes from the earth to the heaven, and the ladder connects them both together. Well, here you have the two columns. And if you look at the symbolism, one has the sun, one has the moon. You see that they are opposites, like light and darkness. Between these two columns on the bottom, you have the Masonic checkerboard floor, black and white. What does that denote? All of the Masonic writers agree that it denotes light and darkness mixing together. Now, let me take that concept and go to the scriptures, and we'll find out they're wrong. Oh, I agree. The white part of the floor represents light. The dark one represents dark, and they're melded together on the same floor. But let me show you how God looks at it. In Genesis chapter 1, Verse 3, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. Verse 4, and God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from darkness. God separates things that are opposite. Think of what Paul said. What concord hath Christ with Belial? What agreement hath the temple of God with idols? What communion hath light with darkness? And the answer to all of those is none, zero. They don't commune together. They're not supposed to be together. It's either light or it's dark. But in Freemasonry, in the New Age movement, in the occult, in witchcraft, they're all blended together. So you have these two columns that stand there, and they represent two worlds, our world and the celestial world, the world of spirits, the world of the gods. And they're trying to reach out to each other and join each other. There was a song, a guy out in California said, Pastor, you got to take a look at this. It was by a group called Black Eyed Peas. Now, I don't listen to a lot of this music, but I pulled up the video on YouTube and I watched it. It was a song called Meet Me Halfway. Some of you are going, yeah, meet me halfway. Anyway, it showed, the video showed this woman laying sort of like in the jungle or in the forest. She's of the earth. She's the goddess. She's Gaia. And it showed this man up on a planet or a moon. He's in the stars. He's of the celestial kingdom. She's of the terrestrial kingdom. Paul said, 1 Corinthians 15, there are bodies terrestrial and bodies celestial. And they each have their own body, their own kind. So the song Meet Me Halfway showed him, the celestial guy, and her, the terrestrial maiden, meeting halfway. And they connect together. Take a look at this graphic. They connect together by way of what's called the keystone. It's the keystone. I want you to think about this when we think of the 13 colonies. The keystone is what locks them both together and provides strength for the particular arch. Over here on the right, I want you to notice you have the royal arch. And I'm going to zoom in here. And I want you to see that where the keystone is going to go, you see the all-seeing eye. It's the same one that's on the back of the $1 bill. Now, I've heard Brent Morris enough. He was the part of the Scottish Rite Freemasonry Lodge in Washington, D.C. He's this Masonic author, Masonic historian, things like that. I've heard him enough to know that Masons are trying to distance themselves from this symbol of the all-seeing eye. It's not working. They've been using this symbol for 100, 200, 1,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. They've been using this particular symbol. That eye, that all-seeing eye of providence that is referred to on the Great Seal, again, it's not the eyes of God. When Noah found grace, where did he find it? Not in the eye of God, like who is it? Odin from Thor? He's got a patch over one of his eyes, all right? He's blind in one eye. Guess who Odin is? Think about it. When Noah was looking for grace, where did he find it? Not in the eye. He found it in the eyes of the Lord. Our God has two eyes. I just believe the Bible. But anyway, this all-seeing eye of providence there, blazing and shining its light over the area where the keystone is going to go. Now, the idea of an arch. Think of this. Think of the entrance to a cave. Are caves mentioned in the Bible? Yes. In Genesis 23, 23 is the number for death, and in Genesis 23 you have the story of Sarah's death and Abraham purchasing a cave, the cave of Machpelah. Think of the entrance to a cave. The entrance to a cave, the ground is like this, and the mouth of the cave, in most cases, forms an arch. The mouth of a cave represents a doorway or a portal or an entryway, or let's say, the way the Bible would say it, a gateway. And something, Revelation chapter 9, the pit, which is always characterized in the scriptures as like a cave, the pit is locked. And it needs a key, like the keystone, to unlock it and open it up, because there is this savior down there that's going, hey, get me out of here. I want out. It's hot down here. Okay, that's the Antichrist. He's wanting out of there. So in Revelation chapter 9, what do we see? We see a star fall from heaven, having been given the key to the bottomless pit, and he opens it up. There's a portal, a gateway now being opened up so that this group can go, the group that's down in the deep, these locusts and the angel of the bottomless pit, Abaddon, can now go through the portal and come out into our world. And they're going to do some really, really, really bad things. So, just about 30 miles north of here, I grew up with this thing. All right, I've lived in the St. Louis area for most of my life. We know it as the Gateway Arch. In fact, I just went up there last week. We took a field trip up there with some of our homeschool kids. The Gateway Arch. It's called the Gateway Arch for a reason. Technically, according to Congress, it's referred to as the Jefferson National Expansion Memorial. And I want you to notice that it's on the bank of the river. The river is also a barrier that separates one world from the other. So the symbolism here, I'm just looking at it, I'm going, okay, I think I get this. It's referred to as the gateway to the arch because it represented, and underneath the arch there's this museum dedicated to Lewis and Clark, who Thomas Jefferson sent out there to go map out a, they were looking for a river route from St. Louis to the Pacific Ocean. They didn't find it, but they found a lot of interesting things. So they mapped out what they knew of the country. But anyway, that's what it's referring to. The gateway to the west is what this represents. Just think about it. It represents a portal. My dad tells me that my dad used to work on the Mississippi River. That was his job. He was worked on a dredge boat. They cleared the channel of the river. He says that he was there watching them put in the key piece to the arch. You can see the graphic here. Because here they have the arch and they're building it together and they've got one more piece that's going to lock it all in place. When they put that final piece in, they can take down all of their secondary structures, all of their scaffolding, everything like that, because now the keystone is in place and it's going to bridge the gap between the two, the north and the south, the east and the west, the light and the darkness, the yin and the yang, good and evil, male and female, sons of God, daughters of men. Or let's look at it like this, Osiris and Isis, and they're joined together by the key stone. That's what you're seeing there in that picture of them laying the final keystone in the gateway arch. Here's another graphic here. This is from an old Masonic book. It's called the Royal Arch of Heaven. I want you to notice there on the bottom it says vernal equinox on the right, autumnal equinox on the left, and there in the middle, this the keystone of what brings the arch together is referred to as the summer solstice. Let me explain it to you like this. I want you to look at this and I want you to listen to this, okay? Picture something being on the vernal equinox. And I want you to listen as I draw this out for you from Scripture. The vernal equinox, and it goes up to the keystone. I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. That's where the keystone is. It is at the most high place of the arch. But then, from thence, Lucifer is brought back down again to the autumnal equinox, and it has to start all over again, but he's got to go under the world. He's in the under parts of the world, but he wants to rise up again. This comes to us right out of the Scriptures, and we get an explanation of Lucifer, or let's say the Antichrist, who has the power of the dragon in him. And it has to do with his ability to be in the keystone point, which is the most high place. Remember, the Antichrist sits in the seat of God, showing himself that he is God. That's what the keystone represents. Now, take a look at this. You see the autumnal equinox and the spring or the vernal equinox, and you have the sun and the earth. And let me kind of explain, let me simplify what this means. Not only does the sun, everybody knows this, not only does the sun rise every day from east, goes to the top, that's the royal arch, it's at the most high place at noon, then it goes back down again. So it makes this arching type thing. That's what the sun does every day. That goes from east to west. It also does it from south to north and back again every year. I want you to get this, for 6 months, the sun is below the equator. That occurs from June 21st to December 21st. The sun is lowering itself from the equator down 23 degrees below the equator. And on December 21st, the winter solstice, the sun is at its lowest point down there. The days are short and so on. Then something happens December 22nd. That sun starts rising up again, and it rises up to the equator at the spring equinox, and then rises up another 23 degrees to the Tropic of Cancer, 23 degrees above the equator. That's on June 21st. So now we've made a full circle again. So I want you to get this. 6 months below the equator and 6 months above the equator, 6 and 6, and the connecting point is the summer solstice, June 21st. That's 6 here, 6 here, joined together to make 12 and plus the connecting point, the keystone, which is 13. So what I'm doing is I'm kind of giving you a reason why Freemasonry, the York Rite, and all of these things deal with this idea of the tropics and the precession of the sun, north and south, and so on, because of the numerical significance of it. What we're going to do is we're going to get into the scriptures and find out what this number means. We're going to find out its true origin, its true meaning. And I want you, there was something that occurred to me, and I want you to think about this, and we'll touch on it either today or the next time. Remember the first two versions of the Great Seal. And if you want to, you can go back and look at those. You can see them online, look at them, Google or whatever. And I want you to notice that there is something present on both earlier versions of the Great Seal that it looks like that same thing is not present here. But it is. It's just in a, let's say, a mystery form. And I'll show you what I mean by that here in just a little bit. So here, take a look at this graphic. Here you have the image of the keystone. The keystone is what brings everything together. It's what binds the two kingdoms together. You have, it's the bridge, all right? You have the terrestrial world, the celestial world, the keystone brings them together. This is, the keystone is a picture of the Antichrist and his number, one of his numbers. He has several of them. One of his number is the number 13. We're going to bring something in here. I want to show you this, okay? Remember, you have two pillars, and they're joined together by the keystone. There is a video we did several years ago called the Triple Helix. And I spent some time teaching that the two pillars of Jacob and Boaz represent, number one, the two strands, the two parts of the ladder of man's DNA. That's the book that God wrote. Those two rungs of that ladder, those two columns, those two pillars, I believe represent what's in your Bible, the Old and the New Testament. They are the two that are joined together by, in DNA, it's joined together by the four base pairs, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. In the Bible, the two, Old and New Testament, are joined together and brought together by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So there's a perfect image and a perfect match here, all right? And so in this video, the triple helix, I talked about this symbol here. If we were to look on the back of the $1 bill and see the unfinished pyramid, the two bottom corners of this pyramid represent those two pillars of those two columns, Jacob and Boaz, Old and New Testament and so on. But the idea is that the way it is incomplete. It's unfinished. It won't quite bring us to where we need to be. Roman Catholicism teaches that alongside the Old and the New Testament, there is something else that you have to have in order to understand God. And that is papal infallibility and whatever the Pope and the Church says. So it's not the Old and the New Testament that's everything that you need. You've got to have the popes telling you what to believe. So the popes represent the keystone that makes it complete and joins it all together. In other words, Roman Catholicism will tell you if you just read the Bible, there's something missing and you need a third part added to that. That same listen, that is everywhere, but it's particularly here in the Book of Mormon. Joseph Smith, and it actually says another testament. You have the Old Testament, the New Testament, and another testament. Think of what the Apostle Paul told us. If any man, if though we are an angel, like Moron I, though we are an angel from heaven, bring you any other gospel, let him be accursed. There is no other gospel. Paul said, there's no other gospel. Here, Joe Smith says, this is another testament of Jesus Christ. So watch this. You have the Old and the New Testament. You have the two rungs of our DNA ladder. And all of these, God says it's finished. It's done. This is it right here. All these guys say, oh no, it's not done. There's got to be something else that we're going to add to it. So Joseph Smith came up with this. I don't know where he got it from. Book of Mormon. So now the Book of Mormon makes everything complete. Am I just making that up? No, let me show you what Joe Smith said in the beginning, the introduction to the Book of Mormon. He said, the Book of Mormon was the most correct of any book on earth and the keystone of our religion. Joseph Smith, who goes down in American history as having the worst haircut of all of America. Let me take a look at that. Oh, anyway, Joseph Smith, and where did he get that concept? In Nauvoo, Illinois, Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and others who were the leaders of the early Mormon church before they went to Salt Lake City, Utah. These guys, while they were in Nauvoo, Illinois, were indoctrinated and inducted, brought into the Masonic Lodge. And anybody who's ever been both a Mason and a Mormon will tell you, oh yeah, they're like virtually the same. Joseph Smith simply borrowed from the Masonic Lodge the same rituals and the same ideas, and he promoted them inside of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So he said that the Book of Mormon is the keystone of our religion. The Old and New Testament, that's not enough. That won't get you there. You've got to have something added to it. Here's what Jesus said. Jesus said in Revelation chapter 22, if anybody takes this book and adds it to my words that are in this book, I will add to him the plagues that are written therein. I think I would just trust Jesus before I trusted anybody else. Here's what Albert Pike said in Morals and Dogma about the keystone. He said, the keystone of the Royal Arch of the Great Temple of Liberty is a fundamental law, charter, or constitution. That goes with what Joseph Smith said. It is sacred, like the Ark of the Covenant of God, which none could touch and live. And so here's what Albert Pike is saying. He said a keystone represents any kind of constitution or law or book that is sacred and makes the religion or makes everything complete. And I had this idea. I went and looked it up, and sure enough, since he mentioned the word constitution, he said the Royal Arch of the Great Temple of Liberty is a fundamental law, charter, or constitution. I just went and looked. The National Archives Building in Washington, D.C. is where the U.S. Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, and other original founding documents are in this big hall, this big room in the National Archives Building, and I want you to take a look at it. The room itself forms an arch. You see the left and the right rounded sides, and the arch is joined together by a keystone where all those people are standing right there. You see the two pillars and so on, and the entryway and everything like that. Where those people are standing, that's where the original copy of the U.S. Constitution is. It's like they built it. I don't know if they built it and then Albert Pike said that's what it is, or Pike said that's how it should be and they built it surrounding that. But the concept is the same. You have this column, and the Royal Arch bringing them together, and that's what you see in the National Archives building. By the way, on the outside, take a look at this. On the outside of the National Archives building, you have massive amounts of pillars. There's like, if you counted them, there's like 72 of them on the outside. We're not there yet, but we're going to get there because I want you to look at this symbol here, the all-seeing eye and the pyramid. We'll talk about what that means a little bit later on in this whole course on the Great Seal of the United States of America. Getting back to the design of the number 13, many would say, okay, the number 13 represents the 13 original colonies. We sang that song when I was in fifth grade. The stars should represent the 13 states or the 13 colonies. The stripes, 13. The arrows, 13. The olive branch with the leaves and the olives, 13 of 13. 13 rows of stones and so on. So they say, yeah, you're making too much out of it. That just simply represents the 13 colonies, and that doesn't have anything to do with Masonic thought or Illuminati thought whatsoever. That's just how it happened. Take a look at this. Here's a graphic. Here's a map of what was referred to as the 13 original British colonies: Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania. It's kind of right there in the middle. New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire. And look at it again, because I mentioned that Pennsylvania was sort of in the middle between six colonies to the north and six colonies to the south. What is the nickname of the state of Pennsylvania? Take a look. It's called the Keystone State, and there's the Keystone as their logo. In fact, if you drive through the highways of Pennsylvania, the highway number signs are all in the form of a keystone. Why is Pennsylvania called the Keystone State? Because you have the southern colonies and the northern colonies. And even to this day in America, southern people think way differently than northern people do. Isn't that odd? But the southern people, they have their own lifestyle, their own lingo, their own drawl, their own way they talk, their own way they eat. The northern people, same way. And that carried through all the way through the Civil War, and in the 1860s, the South had their way, the North had their way. We are a nation united again, but that unitedness is a little shaky right now. But the southern states and the northern states, and what binds them together is the Keystone. Do you remember before there was ever a Washington, D.C., where was it that our beloved founding fathers, where was it that they decided to put the first capital of the United States in? Where they signed the Constitution, Declaration of Independence. Where did they meet? In the Keystone. This is where the North, the Northern representatives, the Southern representatives came together to meet each other there. Six colonies from down here, six colonies from up here, joining together in the 13th one, which was Pennsylvania, referred to as the Keystone State. And in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, that's where the first capital of this nation was. Do you think that was by chance? You think that was just incidental? I think it was by design. And it shows us the relation that this number 13 has with this Royal Arch. Take a look at this. Here is a very, very interesting similarity. From Numbers chapter 2, we find out that God ordered the Israelites to camp. Wherever they stopped in camp in the wilderness, this is exactly how I want you to do it. I want you to put the tabernacle down, put the ark in it, build the gate around it, and close it off. And then, I want it done exactly this way. I want you to take a look at this graphic. Judah, Zebulun, and Issachar were always to camp on the eastern side of the congregation. Gad, Reuben, Simeon were always to be on the south. Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh was always to be on the west. Naphtali, Dan, and Asher were always to be at the north. So you have 12 tribes, right? You have Zebulun, Judah, Issachar, Gad, Reuben, Simeon, Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh. Ephraim and Manasseh, let me stop right here. Ephraim and Manasseh, you know who they are? They are the two tribes of Joseph. Because we're supposed to have like 12 tribes, right? Actually, they had 13. Take a look at the graphic again. You have 12 on the outside. Ephraim and Manasseh, the two brothers, are divided. They are the divided tribe of Joseph. In the middle of them, around the tabernacle, was Levi. 13. Not just 12 tribes in the wilderness. You actually had, this is how God told them to plant themselves. Numbers chapter 2, go read it. You had 13 tribes. Now here is the really interesting one. When they got ready to leave, when God said, hey, pack up, let's go. The pillar of cloud had moved over to the next valley. Everybody starts folding their tents up, packing everything up, getting all the cattle and horses ready and everything like that. And they were to start. Always. This is how God told them to do it in Numbers chapter 10. Because God is a God of order. God said, since Judah is in the east, I want Judah to be the head. Judah is where Christ comes from. Judah is the head. So Judah always takes off first. So you have the three eastern tribes go first. Then the three southern tribes go second. Then the Levites with all the tabernacle material, they go third. Those on the western side go fourth. Those on the northern side. Think of what Jeremiah said about where the terrible army was going to come from. Joel said it too, the northern army. Guess who was always the tail? Always. It was Dan. Numbers chapter 10, verse 25. And the standard of the camp of the children of Dan set forward, which was the rearward of all the camps throughout their host, and over his host was Ahiezer, the son of Amishaddai. And so Dan, Judah, picture of Christ, was always the head. Dan was always the tail. Why? What was Dan a picture of? What did Jacob prophesy over Dan? Genesis 49:16. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse heel so that his rider shall fall backwards. Christ represents the lamb, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, Judah, that he always goes first. He's the head. Who's the tail? Dan. Dan represents a serpent. And I want you to just kind of ponder this imagery. There's a story in the scriptures. I dealt with this earlier this week in a pure Bible study. You might want to go listen to that and get more information. It's called The Name of Blasphemy. But there is a particular story in the book of Leviticus about someone from the tribe of Dan. I want you to listen to it, and I want you to put on your prophecy glasses and see this story as a prophetic picture of something that's going to happen in the last days. And then I'll show you the scripture that connects it. Leviticus 24:10. And the son of an Israelitish woman whose father was an Egyptian. Think about that. Egypt is always the type of the devil. He has the Pharaoh of Egypt has a snake coming out of his head. There's your clue, Sherlock. Anyway, went out among the children of Israel. And this son of the Israelitish woman and a man of Israel strove together in the camp. And the Israelitish woman's son blasphemed the name of the Lord and cursed. And they brought him unto Moses, and his mother's name was Shelomith, the daughter of Dibri, of the tribe of, there it is, Dan. And they put him in ward, which means they put him in prison, that the mind of the Lord might be showed them. Do you get this? Look at this from a prophetic standpoint. Here is Dan. Here is a son who was born of mixed breed. Did you get that? Sons of God, daughters of men. Egypt and Israel. They're enemies. They hate each other. And yet here is an Israelitish woman of the tribe of Dan who falls in love with an Egyptian man probably before they leave, and she has his son. He is a hybrid of the Egyptians, who even historians will tell you that the hierarchy of the Egyptians saw themselves as gods. He is the son of the Egyptian and the son of an Israel woman from the tribe of Dan. Wow. It's getting interesting. Dan's the serpent. Dan's the tail. And this son, striving with the man from Israel because they hate each other, curses and he blasphemes the name of God. Dun, dun, dun. You're not supposed to do that. So what do? They put him in prison. They put him in war. They hold him there. Where is the beast right now? He's in prison. He's being held there until God decides what he's... I mean, God's already decided what he's going to do with him, until God gets ready to do what he's going to do with him. All right? So you follow that so far. So look in verse 13. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, bring him forth that hath cursed without the camp, and let all that heard him lay their hands upon his head, and let all the congregation stone him. And thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel, saying, whosoever curseth his God shall bear his sin. And he that blasphemeth the name of the Lord, he shall surely be put to death, and all the congregation shall certainly stone him, as well the stranger as he that is born in the land, when he blasphemeth the name of the Lord shall be put to death. So that he was in ward, and then God said, bring him out. So Revelation chapter 9, what happens? The key comes and opens up the arch, the portal, the mouth of the cave, and the beast comes out, and now God's going to deal with him. You cannot blaspheme the name of the Lord, so we're going to stone you. What is that a picture of? In Daniel chapter 2, after Daniel sees the vision of the four kingdoms, and the fourth kingdom, part of iron, part of clay, he sees a stone cut without hands coming through and destroying the kingdoms. This is the Lord Jesus Christ. That's what this stoning represented. So he's going to be put to death. This is a picture of one who rises up in the last days and he blasphemes God. Revelation chapter 13, verse 1. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, and upon his heads, there it is, the name of blasphemy. And then down in verse 5, and there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. Wow. So we're getting an idea here. Dan, who was always number 13, always. And Dan wasn't the 13th son born. He wasn't the last one. But you have Judah first, you have all these other tribes, including Levi, including the two half-tribes of Joseph, Manasseh and Ephraim, all the way down, and Dan was always the rearward. Always the last. He was always the tail. He was always number 13. This number 13, this is part of what it represents. It is a picture. Just as the tribe of Dan is a picture, it is a picture of the Antichrist, and this is one of his numbers. Incidentally, but not accidentally, when you look in Revelation chapter 7, in fact, we could turn there very quickly. Oh, almost turn right to it. When you look at Revelation chapter 7, you see God sealing the 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. In preparation for the last days. And it mentions everybody. It mentions, let's see here, of the tribe of Judah. Judah happens to be first in this list too. Verse 5, tribe of Judah. And you have Reuben and Gad and Asher and Nephilim and Manasseh and Simeon and Levi and Issachar and Zebulun and Joseph and Benjamin. But no Dan. Dan, the 13th tribe, is left out of being sealed. None of the tribe of Dan are saved in the last days. Isn't that interesting? So Dan represents the number 13, or let's say the number 13 represents Dan, who is a serpent, who is the tail, who blasphemes God, It's a picture of the beast. Now, I've been talking about a spirit that works in the children of disobedience. And I can tell you that when you look back in American history, when you see the symbols and understand what they mean, the pyramid, there are no pyramids in America. Come on. And the eagle and the stars, they call it the constellation, by the way. We'll look at that video down the road, all right? But it's called the constellation. But anyway, when you look at these symbols and you look at all of the idolatry that's in Washington, D.C., you begin to get this idea that even though a lot of the people in America consider themselves to be Christians, and I don't doubt that whatsoever, there was already creeping in unawares, don't want to make that mistake again, creeping in unawares a spirit and certain men who were guiding underneath in a secret fashion the course of the new world country, which was the United States of America. And that spirit was working through the children of disobedience. So, Benjamin Franklin, who is one of those children, he was not born again. He did not believe in Jesus. He did not believe in salvation by the cross. He was a Freemason and a drunk and a philanderer. But that's who he was. He was a child of disobedience. It was Benjamin Franklin who put, I don't remember if it was in Poor Richard's Almanac or in one of the newspapers, he wanted all of the colonies to get along and get on board with fighting the British. So he drew this little cartoon and published it. And it's a famous one. You've probably seen it. It's called Join or Die. And I want you to look at it. It shows a segmented or a snake that has been cut apart. And even though there's not 13 sections here, you have South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, and then you have NE, which is New England. So you have the 13 colonies represented as a snake that has been cut in pieces. Wow. I want you to think about that. We're going to deal with that issue in next week's Watchman broadcast, because I'm going to leave you with all of this. There's a lot of things. I want you to study a little bit of American history. I want you to study the number 13 in the scriptures, especially in relation to a certain mystery. And we'll see. Remember what I told you. Go look at the previous versions of the seal. Find out what was on those versions that apparently is not on here, but it actually is. It's just in a mystery form. And I'm going to make you wait to find out what it is. All right? But take a look at this snake again. I want you to think of the spirit of the serpent. And I want you to think of Benjamin Franklin being a child of disobedience, a son of Belial. That's what he was. He was unsaved. He was not born again. And so he draws a caricature of these 13 colonies in the form of a severed and a segmented and cut up serpent. The idea is that he wants all of the 13 colonies to be joined together again so that the serpent can live. And then you remember those banners, and people are still using them now as a form of protest against what we see going on in the government. The serpent coiled up, and the phrase, "Don't tread on me." And everybody says, "Yeah, that's America, man. We don't walk on us. Yeah, we'll bite you." Do you remember back in Genesis chapter 3? It's called the proto-gospel, the first time you could see a picture of the gospel. Because after the serpent beguiled Eve and she did sin, and Adam did too, God put curses in the earth. One of those curses was to Adam that, you know, he was going to raise thorns. One of the curses was to Eve that she would be in pain during childbirth and her desire would be to her husband. The other one was to the serpent. He said, "You're going to eat dust all the days of your life." And he said, "The seed of the woman shall be at enmity between the seed of the serpent," literally the seed of the serpent, "and it shall bruise it," the seed of the woman, "shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel." Remember what was prophesied concerning Dan by Jacob. Dan is a serpent that biteth the horse's heels. So here is a serpent, and the promise of God was is that the seed of the woman was going to tread on the head of the serpent. In Romans chapter 16, Paul says, "May the God of heaven bruise Satan under your feet shortly." And we're looking around in America, and all these people who don't like what's going on in Washington, D.C., are forming themselves with the idea of the serpent saying, "Don't tread on me." I don't have one of those flags flying from my car. I don't. Because I believe, I know what that serpent is and what spirit that is of. And it doesn't take much for me when I see Benjamin Franklin drawing out this severed, segmented serpent. I know what spirit that is. And the concept is, let's join the pieces of the serpent together so that he could live. There's a story about that dealing with Osiris, Isis, their son, the keystone, Horus. And some very interesting things that we see in the King James Bible all related to the number 13. And we're going to look at those next week. I appreciate you watching today. May the Lord bless you. Study these things. Learn these things. Here's what I want you to do. Don't bother reading all this stuff, okay? Learn the scriptures. Read the scriptures. Understand the scriptures. Count the scriptures. That's what John said. Here's wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number. So learn the scriptures, the King James Bible. God will give you light on these things, all right? Hey, God bless you. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye. Where can I spend this?